Fallow followed. Halfway across the dining room, Fallow was intercepted by the captain, who had been in charge of his table. He gave Fallow the sort of solemn smile you give someone in the hour of bereavement. "Monsieur," he said, still smiling in this sad but kindly way, and he gave Fallow a slip of paper. It looked like a bill.
"What's this?"
"L'addition, monsieur. The check."
"The check?"
"Oui, naturellement. You ordered dinner, monsieur, and it was prepared and served. We are very sorry about your friend's misfortune."
Then he shrugged and tucked his chin down and pulled a face. "But it has nothing to do with us, and life goes on, and we must make a living all the same." Fallow was shocked by the crassness of the demand. Far more shocking, however, was the thought of having to pay a check in a restaurant like this.
"If you're so bloody keen on l'addition," he said, "I expect you ought to talk it over with Mr. Rascomb."
He brushed by the captain and headed for the door.
"No, you don't," said the captain.
It was no longer the oily voice of a restaurant captain.
"Raphael!"
he yelled, and then he said something in French. In the vestibule, Raphael wheeled about and confronted Fallow. He had a very stern look on his face.
"Just a moment, monsieur."
Fallow was speechless. But at that moment, Raphael turned back toward the door and broke into a professional smile. A big, glum, flat-faced Asian in a business suit came in through the revolving door, his eyes darting this way and that. Behind him appeared a small, olive-skinned woman, about 50, with dark red lips and a huge carapace of black hair and a long red silk mandarin-collared coat with a floor-length red silk gown beneath it. She wore enough jewelry to light up the night.
"Madame Takaya," said Raphael.
He held up both hands, as if catching a bouquet. The next day, the front page of the City Light consisted mainly of four gigantic words, in the biggest type Fallow had ever seen on a newspaper, "Death, New York Style." And above that, in smaller letters, "Society Restaurant to Tycoon, kindly finish dying before Madame Takaya arrives." And at the bottom of the page, a City Light exclusive by our man at the table, Peter Fallow. In addition to the main story, which recounted the evening in lavish detail, down to the waiters skipping busily over the body of Arthur Ruskin, there was a side story that attracted almost as much attention. The headline read, "Dead Tycoon's Secret, Kosher 747s to Mecca." By noon, the fury of the Muslim world was chattering in over the Reuters wire in the corner of the Mouse's office. The Mouse smiled and rubbed his hands. The interview with Ruskin had been his idea. He hummed to himself with a joy that all the money in the world couldn't have brought him.
"Oh, I am a member of the working press. I am a member of the working press. I am a member of the working press."
Chapter 27 Hero of the Hive. The demonstrators vanished as rapidly as they had arrived. The death threat ceased. But for how long? Sherman now had to balance the fear of death against the horror of going broke. He compromised. 2 days after the demonstration, he cut the number of bodyguards down to 2, one for the apartment and one for his parents' house. Nevertheless, hemorrhaging money. 2 bodyguards on duty around the clock, at $25 per hour per man, a total of $1,200 a day, $438,000 per year, bleeding to death. 2 days after that, he got up the nerve to keep an engagement Judy had made almost a month before. Dinner at the DeDucci's. True to her word, Judy had been doing what she could to help him. Equally true to her word, this did not include being affectionate. She was like one asphalt contractor forced into an alliance with another by some sordid turn of fate. Better than nothing, perhaps. It was in that spirit that the two of them planned their return to society. Their thinking, McCoy and McCoy Associates, was that the long story in the Daily News by Killian's man Flanagan offered a blameless explanation of the McCoy case. Therefore, why should they hide? Shouldn't they go through the motions of a normal life, and the more publicly the better? But would Le Monde, and more specifically the very social de Duchis, see it that way? With the de Duchis, they at least had a fighting chance. Silvio de Ducci, who had lived in New York since he was 21, was the son of an Italian brake shoe manufacturer. His wife, Kate, had been born and reared in San Marino, California. He was her third wealthy husband. Judy was the decorator who had done their apartment. She now took the precaution of ringing up and offering to back out of the dinner party. "Don't you dare," said Kate to Ducci. "I'm counting on your coming." This gave Judy a terrific lift. Sherman could read it in her face. It did nothing for him, however. His depression and skepticism were too profound for a polite boost from the likes of Kate de Ducci. All he could manage to say to Judy was, "We'll see, won't we?" The bodyguard at the apartment, Occhione, drove the Mercury station wagon over to his parents' house, picked up Judy, returned to Park Avenue, and picked up Sherman. They headed for the de Ducci's on Fifth Avenue. Sherman pulled the revolver of his resentment out of his waistband and braced for the worst. The de Ducci's and the Bavardages ran with precisely the same crowd, the same vulgar, non-Knickerbocker crowd. At the Bavardages, they had frozen him out even when his respectability was intact. With their combination of rudeness, crudeness, cleverness, and chic, what would they inflict upon him now? He told himself that he was long past caring whether they approved of him or not. His intention, their intention, McCoy and McCoy's, was to show the world that, being without sin, they could proceed with their lives. His great fear was of the sort of outcome that would prove them wrong, namely, an ugly scene. The de Ducci's entry gallery had none of the dazzle of the Bavardages. Instead of Ronald Vine's clever combinations of materials of silk and hemp and gilt wood and upholsterer's webbing, the de Ducci's betrayed Judy's weakness for the solemn and grand, marble, fluted pilasters, huge classical cornices. Yet it was every bit as much from another century, the 18th, and it was filled with the same clusters of social x-rays, lemon tarts, and men with dark neckties, the same grins, the same laughter, the same 300-watt eyes, the same sublime burble and ecstatic rat-tat-tat chatter. In short, the hive. The hive. The hive. The familiar buzz closed in about Sherman, but it no longer resonated in his bones. He listened to it, wondering if his tainted presence would stop the hive's very hum in mid-sentence, mid-grin, mid-guffaw. An emaciated woman emerged from the clusters and came toward them, smiling. Emaciated, but absolutely beautiful. He had never seen a more beautiful face. Her pale golden hair was swept back. She had a high forehead and a face as white and smooth as china, and yet with large, lively eyes and a mouth with a sensual, no, more than that, a provocative smile. Very provocative. When she grasped his forearm, he felt a tingle in his loins. "Judy! Sherman!" Judy embraced the woman. In all sincerity, she said, "Oh, Kate, you're so kind, you're so wonderful." Kate de Ducci hooked her arm inside Sherman's and drew him toward her so that the three of them formed a sandwich, Kate de Ducci between the two McCoys. "You're more than kind," said Sherman. "You're brave." All at once he realized he was using the sort of intimate baritone he used when he wanted to get the old game going. "Don't be silly," said Kate de Ducci. "If you hadn't come, both of you, I'd have been very, very cross. Come over here. I want you to meet some people." Sherman noticed with trepidation that she was leading them toward a conversational bouquet dominated by the tall patrician figure of Nunnally Void, the novelist who had been at the Bavardages. An X-ray and two men with navy suits, white shirts, and navy ties were beaming great social grins at the great author. Kate de Ducci made the introductions, then led Judy out of the entry gallery into the grand salon. Sherman held his breath, ready for an affront, or at best ostracism. Instead, all four kept smiling mightily.
"Well, Mr. McCoy," said Nunnally Void with a mid-Atlantic accent, "I must tell you, I've thought about you more than once over the past few days. Welcome to the Legion of the Damned, now that you've been properly devoured by the fruit flies."
"The fruit flies?"
"The press. I'm amused by all the soul-searching these insects do. Are we too aggressive, too cold-blooded, too heartless? As if the press were a rapacious beast, a tiger. I think they'd like to be thought of as bloodthirsty. That's what I call praise by faint damnation. They've got the wrong animal. In fact, they're fruit flies. Once they get the scent, they hover, they swarm. If you swing your hand at them, they don't bite it. They dart for cover. And as soon as your head is turned, they're back again. They're fruit flies. But I'm sure I don't have to tell you that."
Despite the fact that this grand literatus was using his predicament as a pedestal upon which to place this entomological conceit, this set-piece that came out a bit shop-worn in the delivery, Sherman was grateful. In some way, Void was, indeed, a brother, a fellow legionnaire. He seemed to recall he had never paid much attention to literary gossip, that Void had been stigmatized as homosexual or bisexual. There had been some sort of highly publicized squabble. How very unjust! How dare these insects pester this man, who, while perhaps a bit affected, had such largeness of spirit, such sensitivity to the human condition? What if he was gay? The very word gay popped into Sherman's head spontaneously. Yes, it is true. A liberal is a conservative who has been arrested. Emboldened by his new brother, Sherman told of how the horse-faced woman had shoved a microphone in his face as he and Campbell left the apartment building, and how he had swung his arm purely to get the device out of his face, and the woman was now suing him. She was crying, pouting, whimpering, and filing a civil suit for $500,000. Everyone in the bouquet, even Void himself, was looking directly at him, absorbed, beaming a social grin.
"Sherman! Sherman! God damn!"
A booming voice. He looked around. A huge young man coming toward him. Bobby Shafflett. He had broken off from another bouquet and was coming toward him with a big barnyard grin on his face. He held out his hand and Sherman shook it. And the golden hillbilly sang out,
"You sure have been making the feathers fly since the last time I saw you. You sure as hell have, God almighty dog."
Sherman didn't know what to say. As it turned out, he didn't have to say a thing.
"I got arrested in Montreal last year,"
said the tow-headed tenor with evident satisfaction.
"You probably saw something about that."
"Well, no, I didn't."
"You didn't?"
"No. Why on earth? What were you arrested for?"
"Peeing on a tree." "They don't cotton to it when you pee on their trees at midnight in Montreal. Leastways not right outside the hotel."
Sherman stared at his beaming face with consternation.
"They threw me in jail. Indecent exposure. Peeing on a tree."
He calmed down a bit. "You know," he said, "I never was in jail before.
What did you think of jail?"
"Not much," said Sherman.
"I know what you mean," said Shafflett.
"But it wasn't so awful. I'd heard all this stuff about what the other prisoners do to you in jail."
He enunciated this as if it were a question. Sherman nodded.
"You want to know what they did to me?"
"What?"
"They gave me apples."
"Apples?"
"Sure did. The first meal I got in there, it was so bad I couldn't eat it, and I like to eat. All's I could eat was this apple that came with it. So you know what? The word got out that all's I'd eat was the apple, and they all sent me their apples, all the other prisoners. They passed them along, hand over hand, through the bars, till they got to me. By the time I got out of there, there was just my head sticking out of a pile of apples."
"Ha, ha, 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 ha."
Encouraged by this favorable gloss put upon jail time, Sherman told of the Puerto Rican in the holding pen who had seen the television crews filming him in handcuffs and wanted to know what he had been arrested for. He told of how his answer, reckless endangerment, had obviously disappointed the man, and how, therefore, he told the next questioner manslaughter. The black youth with the shaved head. He felt a twinge of the original terror. This he did not mention. Eagerly they stared at him, the entire bouquet, his bouquet, the renowned Bobby Shafflett and the renowned Nunnally Void, as well as the other three social souls. Their expressions were so rapt, so deliriously expectant. Sherman felt an irresistible urge to improve upon his war story. So he invented a third cellmate, and when this cellmate asked him what he was in for, he said, "Second-degree murder." "I was running out of felonies," said the adventurer, Sherman McCoy.
"Ha, ha, 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 ha," went Bobby Shafflett. "Ho, ho, 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 ho," went Nunnally Void.
"Ha, ha, 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 ha,"
went the X-ray and the two men in navy suits.
"Hehehehehehehe,"
went Sherman McCoy, as if his time in the holding pen had amounted to nothing more than a war story in the life of a man. The Deducci's dining room, like the Bevardages, featured a pair of round tables, and at the center of each table was a creation by Huck Figg, the florist. For this night, he had created a pair of miniature trees, no more than 15 inches high, out of hardened wisteria vines. Glued to the branches of the trees were scores of brilliant blue dried cornflowers. Each tree was set in a meadow, about a foot square, of living buttercups sown so thick they touched. Around each meadow was a miniature split-rail fence made of yew wood. This time, however, Sherman had no opportunity to study the artistry of the celebrated young Mr. Figg. Far from being stumped for a conversational mate, he now commanded an entire section of the table. To his immediate left was a renowned social X-ray named Red Pitt, known sotto voce as the Bottomless Pit, because she was so superbly starved that her glutei maximi and the surrounding tissue, in the Vulgate, her ass, appeared to have vanished altogether. You could have dropped a plumb line from the small of her back to the floor. To her left was Nunnally Void, and to his left was a real estate X-ray named Lily Bradshaw. Sitting on Sherman's right was a lemon tart named Jacqueline Balch, the blonde third wife of Nobby Balch, heir to the colon aid indigestion remedy fortune. To her right was none other than Baron Huxvald, and to his right was Kate Deducci. During much of the dinner, all six of these men and women were tuned in solely to Mr. Sherman McCoy. Crime, economics, God, freedom, immortality, whatever McCoy of the McCoy case cared to talk about, the table listened. Even such an accomplished, egotistical, and ceaseless talker as Nunnally Void. Void said he had been surprised to learn that such vast amounts of money could be made in bonds. And Sherman realized that Killian was right. The press had created the impression that he was a titan of finance.
"Frankly," said Void, "I've always thought of the bond business as, rather pokey stuff."
Sherman found himself smiling the wry smile of those who know a big, luscious secret.
10 years ago," he said, "you'd have been right. They used to call us the bond bores." He smiled again. "I haven't heard that for a long time. Today I suppose there's 5 times as much money changing hands in bonds as in stocks."
He turned toward Huxvald, who was leaning forward to follow the conversation.
"Wouldn't you say so, Baron?"
"Oh, yes, yes," said the old man. "I expect that so."
And then the Baron shut up, in order to hear what Mr. McCoy had to say.
"All the takeovers, buyouts, mergers, all done with bonds," said Sherman. "The national debt, $1 trillion, what do you think that is? All bonds. Every time interest rates fluctuate, up or down, it doesn't matter, little crumbs fall off all the bonds and lodge in the cracks in the sidewalk."
He paused and smiled confidently, and wondered, why had he used this hateful phrase of Judy's?
He chuckled and said, "The important thing is not to stick your nose up at those crumbs, because there are billions and billions and billions of them. At Pierce and Pierce, believe me, we sweep them up very diligently. We, at Pierce and Pierce." Even the little tart on his right, Jacqueline Balch, nodded at all this as if she understood. Red Pitt, who prided herself on her bluntness, said,
"Tell me, Mr. McCoy, tell me. Well, I'm going to come right out and ask you, what did happen up there in the Bronx?"
Now they all leaned forward and stared enthralled at Sherman. Sherman smiled. "My lawyer says I mustn't say a word about what happened." Then he leaned forward himself and looked to his right and then to his left and said, "But, strictly entre nous, it was a robbery attempt. It was literally highway robbery." They were now all leaning forward so far it became a huddle around Huck Thig's wisteria tree in the Buttercup Meadow. Kate DeDucci said,
"Why can't you come out and say so, Sherman?"
"That I can't go into, Kate, but I will tell you one other thing. I didn't hit anybody with my car." None of them said a word. They were spellbound. Sherman glanced at Judy at the other table. Four people, two on either side, including their vulpine little host, Silvio DeDucci, were honed in on her. McCoy and McCoy. Sherman pressed on. "I can offer you some very sound advice. Don't ever get caught up in the criminal justice system in this city. As soon as you're caught in the machinery, just the machinery, you've lost. The only question remaining is how much you're going to lose. Once you enter a cell, even before you've had a chance to declare your innocence, you become a cipher. There is no more you." Silence all around him. The look in their eyes. Begging for war stories. So he told them about the little Puerto Rican who knew all the numbers. He told them about the game of hockey with a live mouse, and of how he, the hero, rescued the mouse and threw it out of the cell, whereupon a cop crushed it with his heel. Confidently, he turned to Nunnally Void and said, "I think that falls under the heading of a metaphor, Mr. Void." He smiled wisely. "A metaphor for the whole thing." Then he looked to his right. The lovely lemon tart was drinking in his every word. He felt the tingle in his loins again. After dinner, quite a cluster it was that gathered around Sherman McCoy in the DeDucci's library. He entertained them with the story of the cop who kept making him go through the metal detector. Silvio DeDucci spoke up.
"They can force you to do that."
Sherman realized the story made him sound a bit too compliant and was undercutting his new status as one who had braved the fires of hell. "I made a deal," he said. "I said, okay, I'll let you show your buddy how I set off the alarm, but you've got to do something for me. You've got to get me out of that fucking..." He said fucking very softly to indicate that, yes, he knew it was in poor taste, but that, under the circumstances, the verbatim quote was called for. "Hog pen." He pointed his finger in a knowing way, as if he were pointing toward the holding pen in Central Booking in the Bronx. "And it paid off. They brought me out early. Otherwise, I would have had to spend the night on Rikers Island, and that, I gather, is not too terrific." Every tart in the cluster was his for the asking. As the bodyguard, Occhione, drove them to his parents' house to drop Judy off, it was Sherman who was enjoying a social high. At the same time, he was confused. Just who were these people? "It's ironic," he said to Judy. "I've never liked these friends of yours. I guess you've deduced that."
"It didn't require much in the way of deduction," said Judy. She wasn't smiling.
"And yet they're the only people who've been decent to me since this whole thing started. My so-called old friends obviously wish I'd do the right thing and disappear. These people I don't even know, they treated me like a living human being." In the same guarded voice, Judy said,
"You're famous. In the newspapers, you're a rich aristocrat. You're a tycoon."
"Only in the newspapers?"
"Oh? Are you feeling rich all of a sudden?"
"Yes. I'm a rich aristocrat with a fabulous apartment by a famous designer. He wanted to get on her good side. Huh. Quietly, bitterly. It's perverse, isn't it? 2 weeks ago, when we were at the Bavardages, these same people froze me out. Now I'm smeared, smeared across every newspaper, and they can't get enough of me. She looked away from him, out the window. You're easily pleased. Her voice was as far off as her gaze. McCoy and McCoy shut down for the night.
What do we got this morning, Sheldon?
As soon as the words left his mouth, the mayor regretted them. He knew what his tiny assistant would say. It was inevitable, and so he braced himself for the vile phrase, and sure enough, here it came.
"Mainly plaques for blacks," said Sheldon. "Bishop Bottomley is here waiting to see you, and there's been a dozen or so requests for you to comment on the McCoy case."
The mayor wanted to remonstrate, as he had several times before, but instead he turned away and looked out the window, toward Broadway. The mayor's office was at ground level, a small but elegant room on the corner with a high ceiling and grand Palladian windows. The view across the little park around City Hall was sullied by the presence, in the immediate foreground, right outside the window, of rows of blue police barricades. They were stored there permanently, on the grass, or rather on bare patches where grass had once been, for use whenever demonstrations erupted. They erupted all the time. When they did, the police created a big blue fence with the barricades, and he could look out at the broad beams of the cops as they faced whatever raggedy horde of demonstrators was yammering away on the other side. What an amazing array of stuff the cops carried on their backsides. Billies, blackjacks, flashlights, handcuffs, bullets, citation books, walkie-talkies. He continually found himself gazing upon the hulking, cluttered backsides of cops, while various malcontents shouted and growled, all for television, of course. Plaques for blacks, plaques for blacks, plaques for blacks, plaques for blacks. Now the vile phrase was running through his mind. Plaques for blacks was a small way of fighting fire with fire. Every morning, he went from his office across to the blue room, and amid the portraits of bald-headed politicians of years gone by, he handed out plaques and citations to civic groups and teachers and prize-winning students and brave citizens and noble volunteer workers and various other tillers and toilers of the urban terrain. In these troubled times, with the surveys going the way they were going, it was wise, and probably good, to single out as many black recipients of these trophies and rhetorical flourishes as possible. But it was not wise, and it was not good, for Sheldon Leonard, this homunculus with his absurdly tiny head and his mismatched checked shirts, jackets, and pants, to call the process plaques for blacks. Already the mayor had heard a couple of people in the press office use the expression. What if some of the black members of the staff overheard it? They might even laugh, but they wouldn't be laughing inside. But no, Sheldon continued to say plaques for blacks. He knew the mayor hated it. Sheldon had the malicious streak of a court jester. Outwardly, he was as loyal as a dog. Inwardly, he seemed to be mocking him half the time. The mayor's anger rose.
"Sheldon, I told you I don't want to hear that expression in this office again."
All right," said Sheldon. "Now what are you going to say when they ask you about the McCoy case?"
Sheldon always knew exactly how to distract him. He would bring up whatever he knew confused the mayor most profoundly, whatever made him most dependent on Sheldon's small but amazingly facile mind.
"I don't know," said the mayor. "At first it looked pretty clear-cut. We got this Wall Street guy who runs over a black honor student and takes off. But now it turns out there was a second black kid, and he's a crack dealer, and maybe it was a robbery attempt. I guess I take the judicial approach. I call for a full investigation and a careful weighing of the evidence. Right?"
"Negative," said Sheldon.
"Negative?"
It was bewildering the number of times Sheldon challenged the obvious and turned out to be absolutely right.
"Negative," said Sheldon. "The McCoy case has become one of those touchstone issues in the black community. It's like divestiture in South Africa. There are no two sides to the question. You suggest there might be two sides and you're not even-handed. You're biased. Same thing here. The only question is a black life worth as much as a white life? And the only answer is, white guys like this McCoy from Wall Street driving their Mercedes-Benzes can't go around running over black honor students and taking off because it's inconvenient to stop.
But that's bullshit, Sheldon, said the mayor. We don't even know for sure what happened yet. Sheldon shrugged.
So what else is new? That's the only version Abe Weiss is even willing to talk about. He's running with this case like he's Abe fucking Lincoln.
Weiss started all this. The thought troubled the mayor, because he knew Weiss had always entertained the notion of making a bid for mayor himself.
No, Bacon started it, said Sheldon. Somehow he got to this drunk in the city light, this Brit, Fallow. That's how it started, but now it's caught on. It's gone way beyond Bacon and his gang. Like I say, it's a touchstone issue. Weiss has got an election coming up, so do you.
The mayor thought for a moment. What kind of name is McCoy? Irish?
No, he's a WASP.
What kind of person is he?
Rich WASP, all the way. All the right schools, Park Avenue, Wall Street, Pearson, Pierce. His old man used to be the head of Dunning, Spongett, and Leach.
Did he support me? Or do you know?
Not that I know of. You know these characters. They don't even think about local elections because in an election in New York City, voting Republican don't mean shit. They vote for president. They vote for senator. They talk about the Federal Reserve and supply side and all that shit.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do I say?
You call for a complete and thorough investigation of McCoy's role in this tragedy and the appointment, if necessary, of a special prosecutor by the governor. If necessary, you say, if all the facts are not forthcoming. That way you give a little jab to Abe without mentioning his name. You say the law must be no respecter of persons. You say McCoy's wealth and position cannot be allowed to keep this case from being treated the same way it would be if Henry Lamb had run over Sherman McCoy. Then you pledge the kid's mother, Annie, I think is her name, you pledge the kid's mother your full support and backing in bringing to justice the perpetrator of the foul deed. There's no way you can lay it on too thick.
Kind of rough on this guy McCoy, isn't it?
That's not your fault, said Sheldon. The guy hit the wrong kind of kid in the wrong part of town, driving the wrong brand of car with the wrong woman, not his wife, in the bucket seat next to him. He doesn't come away looking so wonderful.
The whole thing made the mayor feel uneasy, but Sheldon's instincts were always correct in these can-of-worms situations. He thought some more. Okay, he said. I'll grant you all that. But aren't we making Bacon look awfully good? I hate that son of a bitch.
Yeah, but he's already hit a home run with this thing. You can't change that. All you can do is go with the flow. It isn't long until November, and if you make a wrong move on the McCoy case, Bacon can really give you some grief.
The mayor shook his head. I guess you're right. We put the WASP to the wall. He shook his head again, and a cloud came over his face. The stupid bastard. What the hell was he doing tooling around on Bruckner Boulevard at night in a Mercedes-Benz? Some people are just determined to bring the roof down on themselves, aren't they? He was asking for it. I still don't like it, but you're right. Whatever he gets, he was asking for it. Okay, so much for McCoy. Now, what's Bishop what's-his-name want?
Bottomley. It's about that Episcopal church, St. Timothy's. The bishop is black, incidentally.
The Episcopalians have a black bishop?
Oh, they're very liberal, said Sheldon, rolling his eyes. It could have just as easy been a woman or a Sandinista or a lesbian or a lesbian Sandinista.
The mayor shook his head some more. He found the Christian churches baffling. When he was growing up, the Goyim were all Catholics, unless you counted the Schwarzer, which nobody did. They didn't even rate being called Goyim. The Catholics were two types, the Irish and the Italians. The Irish were stupid and liked to fight and inflict pain. The Italians were stupid and slob-like. Both were unpleasant, but the lineup was easy enough to comprehend. He was in college before he realized there was this whole other set of Goyim, the Protestants. He never saw any. There were only Jews, Irishmen, and Italians in college, but he heard about them, and he learned that some of the most famous people in New York were this type of goyim, the Protestants, people like the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, the Roosevelts, the Astors, the Morgans. The term WASP was invented much later. The Protestants were split up into such a crazy bunch of sects nobody could even keep track of them all. It was all very pagan and spooky when it wasn't ridiculous. They were all worshipping some obscure Jew from halfway around the world. The Rockefellers were, the Roosevelts even. Very spooky it was, and yet these Protestants ran the biggest law firms, the banks, the investment houses, the big corporations. He never saw such people in the flesh, except at ceremonies. Otherwise, they didn't exist in New York. They barely even showed up in the voting surveys. In sheer numbers, they were a nullity. And yet there they were. And now one of these sects, the Episcopalians, had a black bishop. You could joke about the WASPs, and he often did so with his friends, and yet they weren't so much funny as creepy. "And this church," said the mayor, "something about landmarks?"
"Right," said Sheldon. "The bishop wants to sell St. Timothy's to a developer on the grounds that the membership is declining and the church is losing a lot of money, which is true. But the community groups are putting a lot of pressure on the Landmarks Commission to landmark it so that nobody can alter the building even if they buy it."
"Is this guy honest?" asked the mayor. "Who gets the money if they sell the church?"
"I never heard he wasn't honest," said Sheldon. "He's a learned gentleman of the cloth. He went to Harvard. He could still be greedy, I suppose, but I have no reason to think he is."
"Mm-hmm." The mayor suddenly had an idea. "Well, send him in." Bishop Warren Bottomley turned out to be one of those well-educated, urbane black people who immediately create the halo effect in the eyes of white people who hadn't known what to expect. For a moment or two, the mayor was even intimidated. So dynamic was Bishop Bottomley. He was handsome, slender, about 45, athletic in build. He had a ready smile, a glittering eye, a firm handshake, and he wore a clerical outfit that was similar to a Catholic priest's, but had an expensive look. And he was tall, much taller than the mayor, who was touchy about his small size. Once they sat down, the mayor got his perspective back and thought about his idea. Yes, Bishop Warren Bottomley would be perfection itself. After a few well-delivered pleasantries about the mayor's illustrious political career, the bishop began laying out the financial plight of St. Timothy's.
"Of course, I can understand the concerns of the people of the community," said the bishop. "They don't want to see a larger building or a different sort of building."
No black accent at all, thought the mayor. He seemed to run into black people with no accent all the time now. The fact that he noticed it made him feel mildly guilty, but he noticed it all the same.
"But very few of these people are members of St. Timothy's Church," the bishop continued, "which, of course, is precisely the problem. There are fewer than 75 regular members in a very large building, which incidentally has no architectural distinction. The architect was a man named Samuel D. Wiggins, a contemporary of Cass Gilbert, who has left not a single footprint in the sands of architectural history, so far as I can determine."
This casual reference intimidated the mayor still further. Art and architecture were not his strong suits.
"Frankly, St. Timothy's Church is no longer serving its community, Mr. Mayor, because it is no longer in a position to do so, and we feel it would be of far greater benefit, not only to the Episcopal Church and its more vital manifestations in our city, but to the city itself, since a large taxable entity could be erected on that site, and even the community would benefit indirectly, in the sense that the whole city would gain through the increase in tax revenues. That's why we would like to sell the present structure, and we request your consideration, so that the building will not be landmarked, as the Landmarks Commission wants to do."
Thank God. The mayor was relieved to see that the bishop had gotten tangled up in his grammar and had left an incomplete sentence in the road behind him. Without saying a word, the mayor smiled at the bishop and put his finger beside his nose, like Santa Claus in The Night Before Christmas. Then he pointed his finger straight up in the air, as if to say, "Hark," or "Watch this." He beamed at the bishop and pushed a button on the intercom box on the credenza by his desk and said, "Get me the Landmarks Commissioner." Presently, there was a low beep-beep sound, and the mayor picked up his telephone. "Mort? You know St. Timothy's Church?" "Right, exactly. Mort, lay off!" The mayor hung up and leaned back in his chair and smiled once more at the bishop. "You mean, that's it?" The bishop seemed genuinely startled and delighted. "That's the commission? They won't..." The mayor nodded and smiled. "Mr. Mayor, I scarcely know how to thank you. Believe me, I've been told you have a way of getting things done, but, well, I'm very grateful, and I can assure you that I will see to it that everyone in the diocese and all of our friends are aware of what a great service you have done for us. Yes, indeed, I will." "That's not necessary, Bishop," said the mayor. "There's no need to regard it as a favor or even as a service. The facts you so ably presented to me were very persuasive, and I think the entire city is going to benefit. I'm happy to do something for you that's good for you and for the city of New York." "You certainly have, and I'm most appreciative. Now, in the same spirit," said the mayor, adopting his best school-teacherly tone, which had served him so well so often, "I want you to do something for me that is likewise good for you and for the city of New York." The mayor cocked his head and smiled more broadly than ever. He looked like a robin eyeing a worm. "Bishop, I want you to serve on a special blue ribbon commission on crime in New York that I will be forming shortly. I'd like to announce your appointment the same time that I announce the formation of the commission. I don't have to tell you what a crucial issue this is, and one of our biggest problems is all the racial overtones, all the perceptions and misperceptions about who commits crimes and how our police officers deal with crimes. There's not a more important service you could render the city of New York at this time than to serve on this commission. How about it?" The mayor could see the dismay in the bishop's face immediately. "I feel highly flattered, Mr. Mayor," said the bishop. He didn't look highly flattered, however. No more smiles. "And I agree with you, of course. But I must explain to you that insofar as my activities as bishop of this diocese interact with the public, or let me say the official sector, my hands are somewhat tied, and..." But his hands were not tied at this moment. He began twisting them, as if trying to open a jar of pickled peaches, as he attempted to explain to the mayor the structure of the Episcopal Church and the theology underlying the structure, and the teleology of the theology, and what could or could not be rendered unto Caesar. The mayor tuned out after 10 or 12 seconds, but let the bishop ramble on, taking a bitter pleasure in the man's distress. Oh, it was quite clear. The bastard was filling the air with bullshit to cover up the fact that no rising black leader, such as himself, could afford to affiliate with the mayor in any way, not even to the extent of serving on a fucking commission on fucking crime. And it had been such a brilliant idea, a biracial commission on crime, with a half-dozen good-looking, dynamic black leaders such as the bishop. Bishop Warren Bottomley would resonate with the heartbeats of every decent black person in New York, the very constituency the mayor had to have if he was to win in November. And this smooth, Harvard-educated snake was already wiggling out of his grasp. Long before the bishop had completed his exegeses and apologies, the mayor had abandoned the idea of a special blue ribbon commission on crime in New York City. "I'm truly sorry," said the bishop, "but church policy leaves me no choice." "Oh, I understand," said the mayor. "What you can't do, you can't do. I can't think of anyone I'd rather see serve on the commission, but I understand your situation completely." "I'm doubly sorry, Mr. Mayor, in view of what you've just done for our church." The bishop was wondering if the deal was still on. "Oh, don't worry about that," said the mayor. "Don't worry about that at all. As I said, I didn't do it for you, and I didn't do it for your church. I did it because I think it's in the best interests of the city. It's as simple as that. Well, I am grateful nonetheless, said the bishop, getting up, and you can be sure that the entire diocese will be grateful. I'll see to that.
That's not necessary, said the mayor. Every now and then it's nice to come across a proposition that has an irresistible logic all its own.
The mayor gave the bishop his broadest smile, and looked him squarely in the face and shook his hand and kept smiling until the bishop left the room. When the mayor returned to his desk, he pressed a button and said, "Get me the Landmarks Commissioner." Presently there was a low beep-beep, and the mayor picked up his telephone and said,
"Mort, you know that church, St. Timothy's?"
"Right."
"Landmark, the son of a bitch!"
Chapter 28 Off to a Better Place.
"Listen, Sherman, do you think she honestly cares whether you're a gentleman or anything else at this point? Do you think she's going to voluntarily jeopardize her interests to help you out? She don't even talk to you, for Christ's sake."
"I don't know.
I do know. You don't get the picture yet? She married Ruskin, for Christ's sake, and what do you think she felt for him? I bet she studied the actuarial tables, all right? I bet you she actually studied the fucking actuarial tables."
"You may be right, but that doesn't excuse anything I do. This is a funeral we're talking about, her husband's funeral." Killian laughed.
"You could call it a funeral if you want. To her, it's Christmas.
But to do this to a widow on the day of her husband's funeral, practically on top of the corpse?
All right. Let me put it to you another way. What do you want, a gold star for ethics, or your own funeral?"
Killian had his elbows on the arms of his desk chair. He leaned forward and cocked his head as if to say, "What's that, Sherman? I don't hear you." And in that instant, Sherman had a vision of that place and them. If he had to go to jail, even for a few months, let alone years.
"This is the one time you know you're gonna see her," said Killian. "She's got to turn up for the guy's fucking funeral. She'll face you and 10 like you for the payoff at the end of that one."
Sherman lowered his eyes and said, "Okay, I'll do it."
"Believe me," said Killian, "it's perfectly legal, and under the circumstances it's perfectly fair. You're not doing anything to Maria Ruskin. You're protecting yourself. You have every right."
Sherman looked up at Killian and nodded yes, as if he were assenting to the end of the world.
"We better get started," said Killian, "before Quigley goes out to lunch. He does all our wiring."
"You do that much of it?"
"I'm telling you, this is a standard procedure now. We don't exactly advertise it, but we do it all the time. I'm going to get Quigley."
Killian got up and went down the corridor. Sherman's eyes drifted over the dreadful, blind interior of the little office. How inexpressibly grim. And yet here he was. This was his last readout. He was sitting here, of his own free will, waiting to be wired, in order to steal, through the most indecent sort of deception, testimony from someone he had loved. He nodded, as if someone else were in the room, and that nod said, "Yes, but that's what I'm going to do." Killian returned with Quigley. High on Quigley's waistband, on the left side, was a .38-caliber revolver, in a holster, with the handle facing forward. He came in carrying some sort of attaché case. He smiled at Sherman, in an abrupt, business-like fashion.
"Okay," Quigley said to Sherman. "You'll have to take off your shirt."
Sherman did as he was told. The bodily vanity of the male knows no bounds. Sherman's immediate concern was that the definition of his pectoral, abdominal, and triceps muscles stand out sufficiently for these two men to be impressed by his physique. For a moment this cut through everything else. He knew that if he extended his arms straight down, as if he were simply holding them at his sides, the triceps muscles would flex. Quigley said,
"I'm going to put the recorder in the small of your back. You're going to wear a jacket over there, right?"
"Yes."
"Okay. That'll be no problem, then."
Quigley got down on one knee, opened his attaché case, took out the wires and the recorder, which was about the size of a deck of cards. The microphone was a gray cylinder, the size of the eraser and metal band on the top of an ordinary pencil. First, he taped the recorder onto Sherman's back. Then he taped the wire around his waist from back to front and up his abdomen to the hollow between his pectoral muscles, just above the sternum, where he taped the microphone.
"That's good," he said. "It's down deep. It won't show at all, especially if you wear a necktie."
Sherman took that as a compliment. Down deep, between the massive hillocks of my manly chest muscles.
"Okay," said Quigley. "You can put your shirt on, and we'll test it."
Sherman put his shirt and tie and jacket back on. Well, he was now wired. Cold spots of metal in the small of his back and over his sternum. He had become that loathsome animal, But loathsome was only a word, wasn't it? Now that he had actually become that creature, he no longer actually felt even a twinge of guilt. Fear had remapped the moral geography very quickly.
"All right," said Killian. "Now we're going to go over what you're going to say. You're only going to need a couple of statements out of her, but you got to know exactly how you're going to get 'em, all right? So let's get started."
He motioned toward the white plastic chair, and Sherman sat down to learn the manly art of entrapment. "Not entrapment," he said to himself. "Truth." Harold A. Burns's, on Madison Avenue, had been the most fashionable funeral parlor in New York for many years, but Peter Fallow had never set foot in the place before. The dark green double doors on Madison were framed by a formal set of pilasters. The vestibule within was no more than 12 by 12 feet. Yet from the moment he entered, Fallow was aware of an overpowering sensation. The light in the little space was intensely bright, so bright he didn't even want to seek out the source, for fear it would blind him. A bald-headed man in a dark gray suit stood in the vestibule. He handed Fallow a program and said, "Please sign the register." There was a podium, upon which was a large date book and a ballpoint pen tethered by a brass chain. Fallow added his name to the roster. As his eyes began to adjust to the light, he became aware that there was a large doorway beyond the vestibule, and that someone was staring at him. Not someone, however, but several people. Not several, but scores of them. The doorway led to a short flight of stairs. So many eyes bearing down upon him. The mourners were seated in what looked like the sanctuary of a small church, and they were all staring at him. The pews faced a stage, upon which the service would take place, and in front of which rested the coffin of the recently departed. The vestibule was a second stage, off to one side, and by turning their heads the mourners could see each person who arrived. And everyone turned his head. But of course, this was Manhattan, the Upper East Side. The dear deceased, who reposeth in that box up front? Alas, the poor devil is done for, dead and gone. But the quick and the living, ah, there you have something. They still burn with the lovely social wattage of the city. Not who leaveth, but who cometh in. Let us by all means illuminate them and measure their radiance. They kept coming. Baron Hoxwald, Nunnally Void, Bobby Shafflett, Red Pitt, Jackie Balch, the Beverdages, one and all, the whole bold-faced population of the gossip columns, stepping into the blazing light of the vestibule with faces so suitably grim that it made Fallow want to laugh. Solemnly, they entered their names in the register. He would want to take a look at that list of autographs before he left. Soon the place was packed. A rustle ran through the crowd. A door to the side of the stage opened. People began to rise up in their seats to get a better look. Fallow rose to a crouch. Well, there she was. Or Fallow assumed it was she. At the head of a procession was the mystery brunette, the Widow Ruskin. She was a trim woman, wearing a long-sleeved black silk suit with huge shoulders and a black silk blouse and a black fez-style hat, from which issued a voluminous black veil. That outfit was going to cost the estate a few Mecca ticket receipts. With her were half a dozen people. Two of them were Ruskin's sons, by his first marriage, a pair of middle-aged men, each old enough to be Maria Ruskin's father. There was a 40-ish woman, who Fallow assumed was Ruskin's daughter by his second wife. There was an old woman, perhaps Ruskin's sister, plus two more women and two men Fallow couldn't figure out at all. They sat down in the front row, near the coffin. Fallow was on the opposite side of the room from the door from which Maria Ruskin had come, and through which she might disappear at the end of the service. Some rude journalistic aggressiveness might be called for. He wondered if the widow Ruskin had hired any sort of bodyguards for the occasion. A tall, slender, very dapper figure ascended the four or five steps to the stage in front and went to the podium. He was fashionably dressed for mourning. With his navy, double-breasted suit, black tie, white shirt, and narrow-toed black shoes. Fallow looked at his program. This was apparently a man named B. Monty Griswold, director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He fished a pair of half-spectacles out of his breast pocket, spread some sheets of paper out before him, looked down, looked up, took off the half-spectacles, paused, and said, in a rather fluty voice, "We are here not to mourn Arthur Ruskin, but to celebrate his very full and very generous life." It made Fallow's flesh crawl, this American penchant for the personal and the sentimental. The Yanks couldn't even let the dead depart with dignity. Everyone in the hall would be in for it now. He could feel it coming, the pointless bathos, the dripping spoonfuls of soul. It was enough to drive an Englishman back into the bosom of the Church of England, wherein death and all the major junctures of life were dealt with upon the high ground of the divine, an invariable and admirably formal eminence. Ruskin's eulogizers were every bit as witless and tasteless as Fallow had imagined they would be. The first was a United States senator from New York, Sidney Greenspan, whose accent was exceptionally vulgar, even by American standards. He stressed Arthur Ruskin's generosity toward the United Jewish Appeal, an unfortunate note in view of the just-revealed fact that his financial empire was founded upon the ferrying of Muslims to Mecca. The senator was followed by one of Ruskin's partners, Raymond Radosh. He started off pleasantly enough with an anecdote about a period when the two of them were close to bankruptcy, but then trailed off on an embarrassing tangent about the glories of their holding company, Ray Art Equities, which would keep Artie's, he called him Artie, Artie's spirit alive, so long as loans floated and debentures were convertible. Then came a jazz pianist, Arthur's favorite, named Manny Learman, to play a medley of Arthur's favorite songs. Manny Learman was a fat, red-haired man who wore a robin's egg blue double-breasted suit, which he laboriously unbuttoned after sitting down at the piano, so that the collar of the suit wouldn't ride up above his shirt collar. Arthur's favorite songs turned out to be September in the Rain, The Day Isn't Long Enough When I'm With You, and The Flight of the Bumblebee. This last, the florid little pianist, played in a rousing but not flawless manner. He wound up his performance by spinning around 180 degrees on the piano stool before it dawned on him that this was not a club date and he was not supposed to take a bow. He buttoned up his double-breasted jacket before he left the stage. Then came the main speaker, Hubert Burnley, the movie actor, who had decided that what was needed was the light touch and the human side of Arthur, the great financier and ferry captain to the Arab world. He became mired in an anecdote that hinged largely upon one's comprehension of the problems people have with swimming pool filtration systems in Palm Springs, California. He left the stage dabbing a handkerchief at the corners of his eyes. Last on the program was cantor Myron Brenoskowitz of Congregation Shlomokum, Bayside, Queens. He was a huge young man, a 300-pounder, who began singing in Hebrew in a strong, clear tenor voice. His lamentations began to swell in volume. They were unending and irrepressible. His voice took on throbs and vibratos. If there was a choice between ending a phrase in a high octave or a low one, he invariably went high, like an opera singer in concert, indulging his virtuosity. He put tears into his voice that would have embarrassed the worst hambone pagliacci. At first, the mourners were impressed. Then they were startled as the voice grew in volume. Then they became concerned as the young man appeared to swell like a frog.